This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because our microphones create one all across the state this time of day. The real main streets that we're hunkering down on today because of those sharp winds and all that snow and blizzardy conditions over part of the state, well, that's where we normally meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds. And very soon, we're going to be talking a lot about the Winter Olympics. They're coming up in February. They start the 9th of February, go through most of the month, and we'll be watching with intense interest the women's hockey team because we are joined by phone by Jocelyn Lamoureux Davidson and one of the Lamoureux twins, famous for playing for UND and for Gophers and for other teams since then. And I'm joined in studio by Ashley Thornburg. Jocelyn, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on being named to the national team for the third time. Do you still get nervous being an Olympian even after three times?
I think it's just kind of how you categorize the excitement and energy around the Olympics. And so I don't really get nervous, I guess, but I'm just really excited for the opportunity and excited to show, you know, what our team has been working for 3 years and to have that on display in a couple weeks. And just really excited for the opportunity and the experience that comes along with going to an Olympics.
Well, besides you and your sister, Monique, this is a very experienced U.S. Olympics hockey team. Five will have played in three successive Olympics. Is this the most experienced ever?
I think so. Since I've been on the team, it's probably a little bit more experience than we've had in the past. But we also have, I think it's 13 first-time Olympians. So the veteran pool that we do have has a lot of experience. But then the younger group that we have has some great experience at the international level coming up through the USA program. And so I think we've got a really good mix of both. And we're really excited. And I guess, you know, words can't really describe what it means to be able to represent the red, white, and blue. And so we've got a good group and just chomping at the bit to get to South Korea.
Well, you just won the World Championship as a member of the U.S. Women's National Team. So are you considered the favorites going into the Olympics?
We have the number one ranking right now, and so we'll go in with the number one seed through pool play, and then the playoff rounds will get reseeded. But right now we hold the number one ranking, but I guess we're really just focusing on one game at a time. We play Finland in our first game, and they're going to be a really good matchup. And so we're really not too worried about who's the favorite, who's not the favorite, but just focusing on what we need to do to prepare to come out on top.
Well, walk us through some of your training sessions.
So we're in Florida right now, our team is. And so we've been training in Florida for the last four and a half months. As a team, which is not the normal year. So on other years, we've been in Grand Forks training and skating and working out. And so I guess the typical week, we get to the rink. My sister and I, we get to the rink a little bit earlier than we have to be. And work on the skills, and then we have practice. And then we'll either have an extra skill session after practice or we have a training session after that. And then we actually have a mock schedule. So we have games on Saturday and Monday coming up and then Wednesday as well. So it's going to get pretty busy here in the next couple days. And then we take off at the end of the month.
Well, in the two previous Olympics, you pulled up silver medals, losing to Canada both times. How do you think you compare with Canada this year?
I think, you know, we have a good matchup. We've played them like eight times this season throughout the year so far. And so we went 5-3 with them, or 3-5 with them. And so it's definitely a good matchup. And in these one and done deals where you don't have a seven game series like the Stanley Cup does, it's really just a matter of coming down to details and focusing. Every single shift is an opportunity to win a game. And so every face-off matters, every play matters, every battle matters. And so just approaching each game with that intensity and that attention to detail is really what's going to determine the outcome.
What do you look for when you are watching how the other teams play? Like you mentioned, Finland is your first matchup in the Olympics.
There's a lot that goes into what you're watching for, but just being aware of their best players. They have some really talented players. Michelle Carvenin, she played at UND with my sister and I for 3 years, and so she's their best forward. And so just being aware every time she's on the ice and their tendencies, and they have one of the best goalies in the world with Nora Ratti, and so just being aware of, you know, her tendencies and watching videos and trying to take advantage of that. And then just utilizing our strengths, our team strengths and habits that players have, just trying to exploit that and, you know, attack with speed is really what our team tries to do. And so really trying to put teams back on their heels.
Well, you've played for previous Olympics teams. You've played for UND. You played for the Gophers. You played for the Minnesota Whitecaps, a pro hockey team for post-collegiate players. Given all of that experience and the fact that UND has recently closed their hockey program, how many legacy UND or Gopher players do you expect to meet on the ice playing for other countries?
I think for the women's program, UND, we have, I think it's going to be 8 players with ties to UND that are going to be at the Olympics. And so that's, I think, got to be up there with, you know, Wisconsin and Minnesota with NCAA ties. I know Che Genaway, he was just named to the Canadian men's Olympic team, and so that's pretty exciting to have another UND hockey player there. But yeah, it would have been, I think, more. There's a lot of young players that are playing for their national teams that were committed to UND last year, and so there probably would have been more, but quite a few UND ties that will be going to South Korea.
What kind of advice do you have to young players who are looking to get into college right now? UND, of course, previously well-known as kind of a feeder into the national team with them closing down the women's hockey program. Where does that leave young women trying to get into the game?
Well, I think it's North Dakota, I think, was really growing as far as the state and the numbers and participation for girls hockey. And UND, I think, was a big reason for the growing numbers that were starting to come out of Grand Forks, Fargo, and Bismarck and the other smaller towns. And so without that, I think it's disappointing, but you have to, hopefully we continue to grow the sport in the state and they can aspire to play for other Division I schools, you know, Bemidji, Duluth, Minnesota, Wisconsin. There's a lot of schools out east, and so hopefully, you know, they can have experiences by going to different games that are close by in the WCHA. But it's really, you know, it was sad for my sister and I and the entire program to lose that team, but I think ultimately our goal is to help continue to grow the sport and do whatever we can at a grassroots level to continue that growth.
We're talking with Jocelyn Lamoureux. She's a member of the Olympic U.S. women's hockey team and her twin sister Monique also, and she's speaking to us from Florida. Jocelyn, you co-wrote a letter with your sister to UND President Mark Kennedy after he announced the closing of the program, asking him to reconsider, basically. What's the big picture here? Is women's hockey growing or is it surviving?
I think it's one of the fastest growing sports in the country, I believe, for women. I guess what was disappointing is that there weren't a lot of solutions thrown on the table to try and help save the program. I think there is, you know, a handful of ideas that we could have probably put to use to cut back on budgets. And I understand that NCAA is a business, and there is a bottom line and there's a budget to be made. So I think what's unfortunate is that ultimately multiple University of North Dakota teams have been cut, and I think, you know, it didn't just happen overnight. There was a couple years of, you know, mismanaged budgets, and it was unfortunate that happened. to multiple teams, and then especially obviously with our personal ties to the hockey team, it was sad. But I think the big picture, women's hockey is an Olympic sport, and it's going to continue to grow, and it's a relatively young sport. It's only been in the Olympics for 20 years, and so it's going to continue to grow, and the numbers have continued to increase. As far as participation numbers within USA Hockey. And so I know my sister and I and our brothers are committed to help growing the sport at a state level, and then hopefully continue to send local players to Division I programs or Division III programs and have great experiences throughout their careers.
You mentioned, of course, your twin sister, who is also on the U.S. Women's Hockey Olympic team with you, and your four brothers, all of whom perform at very high levels in the hockey realm. Your dad also formerly playing for UND. Your mom's run lots and lots of marathons and competed on a swim team. Were you kids just born with hockey skates on?
Hockey was always a sport that we gravitated towards, but we definitely grew up playing a ton of different sports. And when it was hockey season, we played hockey. But when it was, spring and fall and the summer, we played different sports and were very fortunate and had the opportunity to really kind of pick what we enjoyed most. We weren't forced into it, but definitely followed our brothers a lot. Our dad played, obviously, but when you have an outdoor rink at your disposal for the winter, it's pretty hard not to just gravitate towards putting your skates on and going and playing outside.
Well, and the sisters here, you are the youngest of the six. The twins all have the four older brothers. I only have one older brother, and I can't imagine what it's like to have three more when it comes to sort of that rough and tumble attitude that older brothers often have. Do you think that they're... is some level of just having to compete with your brothers that really prepared you for the Olympic team?
I think absolutely. We both definitely attribute our success to growing up with having to compete and everything we did with our brothers, and they wouldn't let us play if we couldn't keep up. So we always had to compete. They're older than us, so they pushed us around quite a bit. So I think just kind of growing up in an environment where you really had to fend for yourself just to participate definitely has a part in the journey we've been able to be on. And then as we've gotten older, just the support and willingness to get on the ice with us and help us out with different stuff throughout the summers has been pretty special to share with them. And they've all had great careers in their own right. And so it's been a pretty cool, I think, experience to share with all of our siblings. And I can't imagine not having a big family after the growing up we did with them. But it's been pretty special to share a lot of our experiences with them.
Well, Bill Mallon, who's an Olympic historian, says there have been 127,000 Olympic athletes to date. And it turns out there are 200 sets of twins. So that's a bit of trivia you and Monique can hold on to. Will your families be in South Korea for the Olympic Games?
So our parents are going to be making the trip. We have an aunt and uncle that will be coming that live in Edmonton. And then my husband will be able to make the trip. And so we will have five people coming. And it's really been great. The Ralph Engelstad Arena has helped a lot with the T-shirt sales that we've been doing to help offset the cost because of how expensive it is to make a trip like that. And so we're very appreciative of the financial burden that they've helped ease on the family members that are coming. And so we're really excited to have their support there. And that's, part of the special part of going to the Olympics, being able to share those moments with your family members and the people who have been there along the journey. And so we're really excited to have them there.
A couple of years ago, the head coach for the U.S. women's hockey team sort of took some flack for making you and your sister compete separately for spots on the team. Do people treat you like a package deal a lot?
It just depends. It sometimes has happened, but we know that individually we have to be able to perform on an individual level to make a team. And so I think when we're able to do that and then have the opportunity to play together, we really make a case for ourselves for the chemistry that that we have. And so it's always exciting to be able to play on the ice together. But if it's not, you know, that's, you know, we're prepared to, you know, play with anybody that the coaches think is going to give our team success. And so it's just a bonus when we do get to play together.
Well, your sister Monique played for the Boston Blades. There's a famous video of her duking it out with another skater in one of those big games. And I guess you weren't playing on that team with her. Will your third Olympics be your last?
Time will tell. Not sure. I'd really just focus on the next, you know, 2 months that we have coming up. And we're, you know, both married and both want to have family soon. And so I guess my hope is that able to have family and continue to train. But I don't know what that would exactly look like. But I think it's powerful when, you know, women can have a family and do what they love to do. And so I'm hoping that I don't have to make that decision and I can do both. But I also know that priorities change when you have a family. And so right now I'm just focused on the next 6 weeks and then hopefully, you know, come to a decision, you know, next year sometime on what the plan is.
Outside of being on the national team, you and your sister both work in sort of the strength and performance area and helping all athletes. But I want to ask you specifically about women because I see so many things geared towards women are supposed to slim down and tone up, and you don't see that word strength in there very often. What is your philosophy when it comes to women working out?
I think, you know, strong is beautiful, and I think it gives women and young girls confidence to be able to go into a weight room and move some weight around, and just because you're lifting weights doesn't mean you're going to get big and bulky and stocky. One of our smaller players on the team, who is also the lightest player on the team, pound for pound is the strongest, and she is, you would not be able to tell how much she can lift by looking at her. And so I think it really gives women and young girls confidence to be able to use their body to perform, you know, certain exercises and perform certain tasks when it comes to performance. And so I think, you know, lifting weights is the way to go, and that's all part of the process of getting stronger and being healthy and fit just in everyday life.
Well, Jocelyn, thank you for spending some time with our listeners today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jocelyn Lamoureux and her sister Monique are both members of the women's national team that won the world championship this year. They will be members of the Olympic U.S. women's hockey team, and their first game, Finland versus the U.S., is February 11th. Good fortune to you, Jocelyn.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, oil leaks and the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. It's been about a year since the Trump administration gave the go-ahead to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. Crude oil began flowing through the pipeline in June, and since then, Dakota Access has been mostly out of the headlines. Meanwhile, over the course of the year, the pipeline leaked at least 5 times. The spills were small, ranging from a 20-gallon leak in North Dakota to a 168-gallon leak in Illinois. Energy Transfer Partners, the company that developed and owns the pipeline, says the leaks were all consolidated or isolated on their sites. They were small leaks, but critics say the track record raises concerns about the company and how seriously it takes safety. Aline Brown is a reporter for The Intercept, and she's been looking into Energy Partners. She joined Todd Zwillick, host of Public Radio's The Takeaway, to talk about it.
Well, the entire basis of the protests at Standing Rock in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline was the risk that spills could cause to the environment and to drinking water. You found that spills have actually been happening, even if they're not big ones.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that opponents of the pipeline repeated was that it's not if the pipeline spills, it's when it spills. So now, you know, looking back at the record for 2017, we see that it is the case that the pipeline has spilled. You know, both state regulators and, as you said, industry have said that these are relatively minor spills, that they haven't entered waterways. In a few cases, the federal regulator says that the contamination did enter soil. But yeah, you know, the pipeline has spilled.
Now, is it true that these are relatively small spills that have been contained, that they're basically not an environmental threat because it's, you know, 20 gallons here and 17 gallons there?
You know, it's all a matter of degree, I would say. It's not to the level of, you know, we saw this massive spill this past November on TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline of 210,000 gallons of oil in a farm field in South Dakota. So I think that's the kind of thing that regulators are more concerned about. But again, I think it speaks to the nature of these projects and the fact that they are a little bit leaky.
You also looked at another energy transfer project, another pipeline in Ohio called Rover, slightly different. What about Rover?
So Rover has been under some heat. It's a natural gas pipeline, and that one had a big spill of drilling mud during construction. So that is this liquid that's made up of clay and water, and it's supposed to be non-toxic. But when you put 2 million gallons of it into a wetland, you know, it's a problem. And in this case, that liquid was contaminated with diesel, which is very unusual, according to regulators I've spoken to.
Well, you reached out to Energy Transfer Partners. They run Rover. They run Dakota Access and other pipelines, too. What did they say to you?
They told me that, well, for one, the first three spills on the Dakota Access Pipeline were all during this testing period. So they were before June 1st when the project was in service. And even the last spill, they say, was contained to this concrete area, a pumping station where they monitor the flow of oil. So they say that they were contained and minor.
Well, we reached out to Energy Transfer Partners as well. They said that they take safety seriously, both for their workers and for communities. They said that they deliver 99.96% of the liquid fossil fuel that they transport safely to its intended destination. But Aline, what's the bottom line here? The protesters at Standing Rock made a point that you made at the top, which is it's not a matter of if pipelines are going to spill, but a matter of when. Is that really the takeaway message here, that oil will get into the environment? It's really a question of how much.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of my biggest takeaways is that, you know, we wouldn't be talking about this if it wasn't for the attention that organizers on the ground brought to the Dakota Access Pipeline. So it's really a matter of communities getting involved if we want to be aware of these kinds of realities.
Aline Brown, a reporter for The Intercept, spoke with Todd Zwillick, host of Public Radio's The Takeaway. Coming up on Main Street, we'll have a commentary from Mark Trahant. Chef Rosie will drop by to talk about food, and Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota Republican Congressman Kevin Cramer has decided not to run for the U.S. Senate. Cramer plans to run for re-election this year instead of challenging incumbent Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp. Cramer says the biggest factor in his decision was time with family.
And the one-year campaign of me going to a different city in the country every weekend when I'm not in Washington to raise, you know, millions of dollars, and an additional 51 days in session for the Senate versus the House. You know, just the best thing for our 10-year-old son and for our marriage and our family right now is for me to stay here.
Cramer has held his congressional seat since 2013. So far, Republican State Senator Tom Campbell of Grafton is the only candidate to announce he will run against Heitkamp. The state health department has established 8 regions for medical marijuana dispensaries. The interim director of the department's medical marijuana division, Jason Wall, says the 8 regions are based on the state's largest cities.
Fargo, Bismarck, Mandan, Grand Forks, Minot, Williston, Dickinson, Jamestown, and Devil's Lake.
Wall says a dispensary can be located within a 50-mile radius of each of those cities. The law allows 2 grow centers or manufacturing facilities in the state. Wall says the medical marijuana rules still have to be approved by the Attorney General's office, as well as the legislature's Administrative Rules Committee.
We are projecting usable marijuana being available for qualifying patients near the end of this calendar year, right in the October, November, December timeframe.
The medical marijuana measure was approved by voters in 2016. The 2017 legislature rewrote the measure so it would comply with state law. And North Dakota had the same number of traffic fatalities in 2017 as in 2016. According to preliminary figures, 113 people lost their lives on state roads in each of the last 2 years. Ashley Doan of the State Department of Transportation's Safety Division says there were 2 main causes in 2017.
Nearly 61% were still not wearing their seatbelt, and nearly 41% were alcohol-related. And that is still pending, you know, due to the final toxicology results, but those are 100% preventable. So we hope the message continues to get out there to the people that they need to buckle up and find a sober ride home.
Doan says speed was a factor in 24% of the fatalities. She adds that traffic deaths have decreased 34% since 2012, when 170 people were killed.
The good news is crashes are preventable. So we hope that, you know, people start to understand that, you know, when they get behind the wheel, they need to put their phones down. Don't be a distracted driver. Drive distraction-free, buckle up, and always drive sober.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
So the next girl said, you know, I just did something. I just put a little hose. I know he was going away for the weekend. I put a hose in the bathroom window and turned it on and left. And so that was, I think, nice and simple. Very nice.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about being surprised. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a journalism professor at UND and the author of Trahant Reports Online. He's also an enrolled member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, and he follows Native American issues closely. Today, his commentary is about the controversial nominee to head the Indian Health Services.
The Indian Health Service is Indian country's largest employer, with more than 15,000 people on the payroll. And many, many more people who work in healthcare for tribes, nonprofits, and other related agencies. The IHS budget is $6.1 billion. Yet it's also the least funded national healthcare delivery system. The Wall Street Journal published a story last week about the controversial nomination of Robert Weaver, the Trump administration's pick to head the Indian Health Service. The journal raised questions about his role at St. John's Regional Medical Center in Joplin, Missouri. Weaver is a member of the Quapaw tribe of Oklahoma. These are the facts. Weaver will be the least educated director of the Indian Health Service ever. If confirmed, Weaver would be the 10th permanent director, and all but one prior to Weaver have been physicians, most with multiple degrees in public health, science, and health administration. Weaver is not a college graduate. His background is insurance. In a September 2016 profile in Native Oklahoma magazine, he said his business saved the Quapaw tribe more than $5 million a year. The problem here is one of scale. He owns a business where he can hire and fire at will. But at the Indian Health Service, most of the key personnel decisions are made by folks in the chain of command, sometimes even as a favor to a United States senator. And firing? Just one action could take up more time than the 3 years left in this administration. And that's the easy stuff. The agency's operations are complicated by Congress, law, regulation, tribal relations, the Veterans Administration, Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. To his credit, Weaver has been outspoken about the underfunding of the Indian health system. My question, will he say so again in his confirmation testimony? Perhaps the Indian Health Service should be led by someone with an insurance background. It would surely help if the agency could come up with a better funding model, including a mix of insurance funds. But it's a complex organization, and he would be managing jobs that he himself could not be qualified to run, such as hospital administrator. Just what are the qualifications necessary to run the Indian Health System? I have a bias. I met some of the great physicians who ran the agency. I remember Emory Johnson's passion and thoughtfulness about what IHS could be. So the standard for me, at least, is high. Then the Trump administration likes the idea of shaking up government. And appointing someone to run the IHS with a very different background does just that. We would do well to remember a phrase that medical doctors learn early in their training. First, do no harm. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and read his commentaries at Trahant Reports, that's TRAHANT reports.com. Chef Rosie is next.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 138 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We all love jokes, but do we need them? We want to laugh, but is laughing itself important or just a distraction from the heavier, more meaningful aspects of life? On Next Why, we'll ask these questions and see, hopefully, that philosophy can be serious and funny at the same time. Join me and Al Ginny for Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives on Why Radio, Sunday, January 14th at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Rosie. We are going to talk about, well, something that grows all around us, apparently. We're famous for it.
Yeah, almost. Talk about eating loco. Well, so easy to do when it comes to the great amount of beans that we grow here in the northern Great Plains.
You know, in North Dakota and Minnesota, the amount of edible dried legumes, beans we're talking, we're one of the largest growers in the country. One of the largest marketing associations in the country is the North Dakota, Minnesota Dried Bean Board. They have millions of dollars in marketing, but they're just an amazing legume. They're amazing to eat. They're amazingly good for you. They're loaded with vitamins and minerals and nutrients. And there's so many different varieties and so much we can do with them. And they're so inexpensive that they should be in everybody's cabinet.
Well, yeah, they're so cheap. You can buy just bags and pounds of the dried beans for couple bucks, it seems like. But then, of course, there's always the hassle when you get them dry versus in a can. So walk us through dried beans. How long do you really need to soak them?
Well, I think I'll do it in two parts. Yes, all of the beans we're going to talk about today, we can buy all of them dried, and they're all grown right here. And we can buy all of them in a can. And some people say, oh, I would only buy the ones in a can because when I want them, I can have them 1 minute later. When I open the can, they're ready. But the texture difference between making them from fresh or dried versus from the can is night and day indifference. Uh-huh. When they're in the can, you can tell that texture. It's very mushy. When I make black bean soup, I don't think I would consider making it with canned black beans. I just couldn't do it. One of the big controversies of all these different beans we're going to talk about is you have to soak them. And as we said, whether it's 12 hours or 24 hours, just remember the longer you soak them, the more vitamins and minerals you leach from the bean itself. So I'm here to say, change your thought process. For years, we always soaked them in water and threw that water out. And we did that to get rid of the rocks, the stones, the pebbles. Well, beans are very clean now. We don't have to worry about getting a mouthful of rocks. And if you throw away that water, just remember that most of the vitamins and minerals and nutrients, they're water soluble and they are leached by the water. So I'm here to say, don't throw away the water anymore. You're just throwing away the vitamins and minerals. And most of these dried beans, you know, they're called a superfood. They're called a super ingredient for a reason. You know, it's, as you said, Ashley, the cost is so nominal and the flavor is so incredible that I think it'll be fun to talk about the 8 different varieties that we grow in this part of the country.
But of all these varieties, if you have that water left and you're making soup, then you would use that water? Is that what
Absolutely. Whether I'm making soup or I'm making a black bean relish or I'm making a cranberry bean as a starch for my meal to go along with my pork loin, I would always use the water.
So you're going to keep most of the health benefits. Do you keep some of the flavor, too? Like, will beans taste different if you cook them in a different water than you soaked them? Or
I don't know if it'd be noticeable. Okay. I'm not sure. Because I threw away the water for the first 40 years of my life. So this is new to me as well. I'm just not going to do it anymore.
So what kinds of ones do we grow around here?
You know, probably the biggest two would be the black bean and the great northern bean. And having lived many years in Florida, and Miami in particular, the Cubans and the Latins know how to make black bean soup like no other. And I remember a time when I'd never saw black bean soup in the Midwest, but now you see it everywhere all the time. And it's almost always the Cuban variety, the Latino variety, with cumin and garlic and chili powder. Wonderful bean, great flavor. Another bean that we grow a lot of here is called the cranberry bean, and that's that bean that in Arizona it looks very much like an Anastasi bean. It's the bean that has magenta streaks through it. It looks kind of like it's painted paisley, but you see red, magenta, cranberry color, and it's known for having a chestnut flavor, a wonderful bean. And then another bean that we have here would be the navy bean. And I guess it got the name as the navy bean because it was served. It was a staple in the United States Navy.
Probably stored well on long voyages.
All of these beans store amazingly well. And as Ashley, as you said earlier, forever. You know, it's not like, what's the shelf life? The shelf life is as long as you don't have bugs in your cabinet. Because as soon as you have bugs, then they're gone.
That's practical.
Another bean that we have a lot of here would be the kidney bean, and of course it got its name, the kidney bean. It's the bean we use to make chili. It can be light red, it can be dark red, it can be small, it can be large, but most importantly it has the shape and the color of a kidney.
Hmm. Sounds good. Blind taste test, could you tell these apart?
You know, we talked about that this morning, and I'm not sure if I cook them all with onions and garlic and cumin and lemon and bay leaf. I think, you know, there's a couple that I could pick out for sure. It'd probably be the black bean I could pick out. But once you add all the other flavors that make it, or in the case of the bean soups that we make with smoked pork, once by the time you add something smoked to any one of these, each one of them can make the exact same recipe. Absolutely.
Okay. I like interchangeability in a recipe.
This is a very efficient crop, too. I mean, it grows obviously very well where we are. It doesn't need a lot of water.
It doesn't need a lot of water. It's very energy efficient. It has a huge production per acre. The one thing you have to be extremely careful of when you're growing dried beans is you've got to be careful in the spring, especially in our part of the country, because you never know when winter is really over, when we're going to have that final freeze. Mm-hmm. But they don't take freezing. If they're popped out of the ground and there's a freeze, the crop is gone. Mm. They like that 50 to 85 degree temperature. They like that black, fertile, dark soil that we have in this part of the country. And even though we're the largest grower of them, we're not the biggest user. Central Americans, South Americans, Mexicans use a lot more dried beans in their part of the world than we do here.
Oh. You called it a superfood earlier. What's it got going?
Well, it's a superfood because it's loaded with essential nutrients, protein, fiber. We call them the complete nutrient package, all in one. They're an amazing bean because they're also low in fat, they're cholesterol-free, they're good for weight control, and they're good to control the risk of heart disease. So what more could you have in a superfood than all of those applications?
Well, we are in the kind of beans and franks part of the season in the upper Great Plains, but there are bean dishes around the world. It's a pretty versatile crop.
It is. It's not only versatile in the fact that it can grow in many different climates, but the fact that it takes so little water is what makes it a really amazing crop to grow, because it doesn't need the constant water that so many of our other crops need. For a stalk of corn, for instance, what does it take? 10 times its weight in water to grow each ear of corn. So it's pretty amazing where this takes. It can go for weeks and weeks without water, just grabbing the nutrients from the soil.
Wow, I didn't know that. And I have seen beans used a lot in sort of the healthier sweets. You see brownies. I've made cookie dough or a fake cookie dough with garbanzo beans. I've seen red bean ice cream. Do you need to do anything different with the beans in order to use them in a sweet?
It's interesting that you brought up red bean ice cream, because all of these beans have sweet applications as well. Mm. Nobody in this part of the country knows about those, but in other parts of the world, in Asian countries primarily, red bean ice cream, red bean sorbet, and all of these different beans they're used in brownies, they're used in sweet custards, they're used in quiches, they're used in, so when they're ground up into a powder form, you can use it in all the places that you would use flour. So yes, they're all gluten-free, And yes, none of them have the strength and elasticity of flour, but all of them add the structure that flour adds to a cookie, the structure that flour adds to a brownie or a cake. So it has all that. It just doesn't have the strength and elasticity that we need to make pizza dough mm-hmm. or bread or things like that.
So if you're going to be baking with it, better to get the powdered form, or can you get it dry stuff and then just run it through a food processor?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I just don't know where I can buy any of these beans in powdered form. You know, commercially, it's used in all kinds of application as an ingredient in pet foods and lots of health foods. But I'm just not sure of where in the grocery store I would find pinto bean powder or black bean powder. But it's a commercial ingredient, so I know it's very well available. But it'd probably be a health food specialty store where you could find that.
Well, beans are wonderful, obviously, and they're great for the economy up here, too. If you have a question for Chef Rosie about beans or anything,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public.
And we'll have more Main Street in a moment.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week I chat with Yotam Ottolenghi about his latest cookbook, Sweet, a great mix of French and English desserts married to the flavors of the world. Also up this week, former Eater editor Helen Rosner, our recipe for sumac chicken, a tip for cooking onions, and Dan Pashman of The Sporkful asks what it would be like to have Willy Wonka as your dad. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's that question plaintively sung, and it's time to look at our calendar and find out things to do. Ashley Thornburg and I do this every Thursday.
And here's a fun thing to do that also stands to make your life a little bit easier. You can learn how to make yogurt on Tuesday the 16th in Bismarck at the Bisman Community Food Co-op. Yogurt, of course, has lots of probiotics and things that are very good for your gut health. And you can learn how to make this at home, again, at the Bisman Community Food Co-op, Tuesday, January 16th in Bismarck at 6 p.m., and it is free.
Well, last week we talked with Jill Weiss, one of the players for Cottonwood, about this event. It's coming up this weekend, Blizzard Bluegrass Concerts, Friday and Saturday in Bismarck at the Bismarck State College Sidney J. Lee Auditorium. Cottonwood Bluegrass Band from Washburn and around the Bismarck-Mandan area in cooperation with Bismarck State College hosts its 13th Blizzard Bluegrass Weekend. Two concerts will also feature High Plains Traditions Bluegrass Band. These will be at 7 o'clock Friday and Saturday. There will also be a bluegrass workshop from 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday. Again, it starts at 7 o'clock, and take it in. It's fun. $5.
There is a North Country Fiddle Community Dance Saturday the 13th in East Grand Forks at the Eagles Club. You can do-si-do and learn all sorts of fun other dances with the fiddle music played by the O'Neills. This is Saturday, January 13th in East Grand Forks at the Eagles Club, and it's free.
Dinner Theater presents Daddy's Girl in Jamestown at the Arts Center. It starts this evening. It runs through Saturday. In this comedy, you'll meet Bernard Maluvi, proprietor of Maudie's Diner, the most no-nonsense cook you've ever met. Bernard gets served a plate of comic chaos when his deceased wife decides to take up residence as a talking portrait on the diner wall.
I want to do that.
It's a single set with zany characters, a heart of gold. Make this a great night out for the whole family. It's 6 o'clock. Again, it starts Thursday to this evening, Friday and Saturday. It costs from $30 to $35.
The Jamestown Corallaires Concert, Friday and Saturday, January 12th and 13th in Jamestown at the Rhineland Fine Arts Center. This is a male chorus from the community of Jamestown presenting lighthearted winter concert, a wide variety of styles and songs. You know, kind of like if you're flipping through the radio, hearing lots of different styles. 7:30 Friday and Saturday in Jamestown at the Rhineland Fine Arts Center. It is $5 for students and $12 for adults.
This event is called Refugee Awareness, Welcoming the Stranger. It's Sunday in Minot at Main Street Books.
You can join Main Street Books as they welcome Lutheran Social Services and some new Americans to share their experiences as refugees from their homelands. All of these refugees now call North Dakota their home, and they're excited to share their stories. Refreshments will be served. It's from 1 to 3 in the afternoon on Sunday at Main Street Books in Minot, and it's free.
There is a 10th annual Healthy Family Fun Night Saturday, the 13th, in Bismarck at the YMCA, and this is something that the YMCA is doing along with the University of Mary Marauders, hosting the Healthy Family Fun Night, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Y. Admission is $5 per family. Proceeds benefiting the annual campaign that the Y does that sometimes helps them give out scholarships and teach different classes. 6 to 8 p.m. on Saturday the 13th at the Bismarck YMCA, and again, it is $5 per family.
I just spoke about a New Americans event in Minot. There's one in Fargo on Sunday. Letitia Mazura-Hellerud is giving a book reading. We've had her on our show. Immigration and refugee issues have never been a hotter topic, so it's worth it to hear from the perspective of those who've had to flee their homelands. Letitia Mazura-Hellerud bounced between countries for years before finally settling down in West Fargo. She's written a book, Being at Home in the World, and she'll read from her book and discuss what home means to her at 2 in the afternoon Sunday at the downtown Fargo Public Library. This event is free and open to the public.
Local performers at Grand Forks at the Half Brothers Brewing Company on Saturday the 13th. Powers and Pitcher playing along with Allie Root. And this is Gina and Nathan from the Gina Powers Band. And they are returning to the Half Brothers stage with sweet vocal harmonies and excellent songwriting. The opening act is going to be Grand Forks-based Allie Root, who is going to be performing alongside Chris Johnson. 9 p.m. on Saturday the 13th in Grand Forks at the Half Brothers Brewing Company, and it's free.
The Avalon Endless Possibilities Wedding Expo is Sunday in Fargo at the Avalon Event Center. A day of fun and prizes, live bands, 60-plus vendors, free samples of food, three fashion shows, over $25,000 in prizes, including a $10,000 wedding at the Avalon, a wedding dress from Allen Evans, a honeymoon from Travel, and a tuxedo package from Tip Top Tux, plus many more opportunities, including opportunities in the cash cube. That sounds like you get to grab some money. 1 to 5 in the afternoon on Sunday in Fargo at the Avalon Event Center. The cost is $5. You can get a VIP ticket for $25.
Boy, it sounds like even if you're not getting married, for $5, you can eat a whole lot of cake samples.
I am ready.
Just throw that out there. All right, my pick of the week is The Odd Couple, the female version, Friday through Sunday, January 12th through the 14th, in Minot at the Arlene Theater. Unger and Madison are at it again, but this time it's Florence Unger and Olive Madison, that is, in this female version of The Odd Couple. So it's not necessarily always a poker party. Maybe it's Trivial Pursuit. But anyway, hilarious antics will prevail. Friday through Sunday in Minot, 7:30 for the evening performances. There is a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday. Tickets are $10 to $15.
Well, my pick is The Tell. It's tonight. Everyone has a story to share, and The Tell has been giving people the means to do it in front of live audiences. The Storytelling Challenge fires up the new year with this month's theme, which is Unstoppable. All you need to do is buy a ticket for the event at Drecker Brewing Company in downtown Fargo and enter your name in the hat, and how it's drawn is what your luck will be. The event's founder, and this is important, Laura Eglund, is moving. So this is her last turn as host, so let's turn out for Laura. Warren Christensen will be providing tunes between the stories. So The Tell, this evening at Drecker Brewing in downtown Fargo. Tickets are from $12 to $22, and the event starts at 7 o'clock. And that's what's happening.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with the developer and founder of U-Code Girl, that's Betty Groneberg, and we'll have a musical performance from December's Children. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 11th. Life in McKenzie County was a new experience for the Reverend Richard C. John. The 20-year-old seminary student had answered a call for a minister from Schaefer, North Dakota, in the fall of 1915. He traveled by train from Missouri to reach his new post by November and found lodging with a bachelor homesteader in a cabin about 20 miles east of Watford City. John, or Yin as he was known, kept a daily journal for the 317 days he preached for several Lutheran congregations scattered around McKenzie County. He experienced all the joys of a winter on the open range, sinking temperatures, blizzards, icy travel, and strong winds. He passed the time writing sermons and letters, doing housework, including dreaded dishwashing, visiting neighbors, and conducting his services in English and German. On this date in 1916, John wrote of a low temperature of 61 degrees below zero at Watford City. Stormy weather kept him indoors at a neighbor's, where he had arrived 2 days earlier for a confirmation class. He and his neighbors sat around the stove as a sand-like snow fell, driven by a fierce northwest wind. He read during the day, cut some wood, ate bean soup, and slept on a miserable cot. The next day, he returned to his cabin under a sunny sky and a high temperature of 41 below. John was a well-respected community minister. He baptized, confirmed, and buried a number of residents. His first deathbed service was for a man mangled by wolves in an extremely rare attack. In September of 1916, John returned to seminary. But before he left, he remarked on his time out west, "I can hardly wait till I shall be permitted to leave here, and yet I shall miss the free and wild life of McKenzie County greatly." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
He'd always wanted to record in a prison, and 50 years ago Saturday, he made it happen.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when.
The anniversary of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
But that train keeps rolling.
Friday on Main Street, UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, will preview this Sunday's episode with Al Jenny. Jenny is a professor at Loyola University in Chicago, and their topic is humor. We'll also have our Friday chat with news director Dave Thompson about the week's big stories, and Matt Olean will review two more movies. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.